Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Griefsters. Hope you're having an okay week, wherever you are listening. Thank you so much for your lovely messages about last week's show and all the new episodes of this season. It's so appreciated. If you have been enjoying this season as ever, if you'd like to rate, review or subscribe, or simply tell someone you think would enjoy the show. There's lots of people out there who might be afraid to listen. And I always start with, it's cheerier than it sounds. So if you have been enjoying it, thank you. And if you can spread the word, it will mean we can keep on making the Griefcast. Thank you. This week, I'm talking to the brilliant actor and writer, Emily Bevan. Emily has been in a plethora of things. She's been in Doc Martin, The Thick of It, St. Trinians, the BAFTA-winning In the Flesh, and she is the author of the brand new book, The Diary of Losing Dad, A Bittersweet Journey Through Grief. It's published by Unbound. It's available to buy now. It's such a beautiful book, and it's, all about how she felt dealing with her own grief of losing her brilliant dad, Nick, which we talk about a lot on the show. So here's me talking to Emily. I hope you enjoy. So Emily, who are we remembering today?
So we are remembering my dad, Nick Bevan, who died on the 12th of January 2014.
14. How many years are we? Sorry, my maths is so bad.
So 8 years. No, my maths is awful as well. So I had to work it out as well. Yeah. 8 years ago.
8 years ago, wow.
And he was 71. I was 31.
Wow. Okay. Hey, God, that's terrifying in some ways, because when you said 2014, I literally was like, so what, 2 years ago? Like, oh no, that's 8 years ago. Wow. So yeah, you're heading into that slightly funny territory, I think, where to some people it seems like a long time ago. To people who aren't in the club, as we say, that's like, oh, a long time ago. But actually, I would say you're heading towards a 10-year anniversary, which is a big chunky one, I felt, for me. I don't know.
Wow, really?
But like, is that how you're feeling, that slightly people are like, oh, you're still... Oh,
right. Still feeling sad about that,
are
you?
Yeah.
I think it's a funny one, because I obviously... it's because I wrote about Dad in a book, and I sort of was writing up diaries that I kept around the time that he was really unwell. And so I feel like I've gone through various stages of grieving, because I had the kind of running away from it and not wanting to talk about it and being really kind of manically positive, and then being completely distraught and sort of crumbling on the floor, and then being manically positive again. And then, did you have that? The sort of like intense kind of trying to be normal, and then just crying in the supermarket when they didn't have the right beans, and then being really kind of quite normal again. And then I felt like I was like that for quite a long time. And then the sort of gaps between, you know, crying on the floor got a little bit wider.
Yeah.
But I think essentially I was running away from kind of how I was feeling, and I always wanted to present that like I was doing really well. And I was kind of quite busy as well at the time, and I was working a lot, and that was a really good distraction.
Yeah.
And then it all caught up with me about 3 years later when I went on a big holiday. I went to India. It sounds such a cliche, doesn't it? But I did. I went to India and I had a revelation. But I just had this really strong urge to write about it and to look at my diaries and rewrite them. And I was listening to Griefcast at the time, and my brother had told me about your podcast. And it was a really strong, profound thing of wanting to write my own story.
Yeah.
And in writing the book, I think I really dealt with a lot of stuff. I think it was sort of choosing language and kind of putting it into a bit of a box marked grief, and sort of the selection of words, and then going over it and editing and editing and editing. I think I did a huge amount of work on how I was feeling when I was writing.
Yeah.
And then it's quite funny that now, you know, it is 8 years on, and I feel like I'm experiencing everything in a completely new way.
Mm.
And it's funny because I've chosen these words, and that they're words that I, as I said, I edited, I poured over draft after draft. But if I go just a tiny bit off-piste and I start unpicking maybe a sort of scene from the book that I've kind of fixed in a certain way, it's like, whoa, okay, not okay. Everything is so raw around the edges. Yeah. It was really interesting to discover that. Like just the other day, I was sort of just expanding on something that I'd written, and I felt like there was just this whole universe of grief that I'm just not, haven't even gone there yet. And so it's interesting that you say 10 years is a big one, because I can feel that, you know, and also being a mother now and having a kid and sort of experiencing my dad, or sort of thinking about him in a different way as a parent now that I'm a parent, and trying to explain to my daughter, you know, that the guy on the fridge is mummy's daddy.
Yeah, it's a lot.
That's really upsetting.
Yeah. I think the writing thing's really interesting to say. You've written this book. It's called The Diary of Losing Dad. That's right.
Yes, isn't it? That's
Yeah. It's called The Diary of Losing Dad. And I found it really interesting reading it that, one, that you had kept diaries, because I was unable to write anything down. But obviously I was a teenager, very different situation. And I was wondering, you know, the fact that you sort of kept them, put them over there, then went back to them. I thought, God, that must have been so interesting to go back. Because I wrote down maybe 5 or 6 things. And in writing my book, I dug up this notebook that I bought from Miss Selfridge. And I found a few things. And I was like, oh my God. Because it's like meeting someone, for me, it was like meeting someone I didn't recognize. Yeah. I was like, who is this person?
Completely.
And the way they saw their grief as well, I was like, oh my God. Like the things I thought were so solid of like, you know, I'm fine, I don't feel anything, it's gone, like I think I'm okay, like just really like, and if you'd gone to carry out at that point, I would have, you know, put money on it, I would have said, yeah, I'm fine. So I thought, how did it feel going
like
back to
these diaries? Like you've had a cold or something, it's gone, I had a cold, it's gone.
Yeah, it was a bit, well, it wasn't great, was it, but I'm fine now, fine, yeah, great. Yeah, how did it feel going back to those old notebooks? Was that kind of...
They're quite difficult, because it is weird that I was keeping a notebook at the time, and it's something that I've kind of
it's
done.
It's definitely not weird.
Off.
I think it's great. I just admire people who can write it down.
But it's only, I haven't really done it before or since, interestingly. And so it was around a time, so I knew Dad was ill, and I remember sort of writing a poem about him on holiday about, you know, the fact that he was ill. And then I just sort of kept going. And there was also quite a lot of interesting things happening, and I just wanted to remember details of life. And then it just turned into this sort of diary about Dad. But there was a weird thing that happened. So my dad had renal cancer, and we'd known about it for a while. He'd had a kidney removed. Everything went well. He was all set to start with a really good new drug that's really effective for renal cancer.
Yeah.
And basically, he had a stroke out of nowhere.
Wow.
And I found out about that when I was in Berlin to do a short film with a friend of mine. And I was literally going to get into my costume, looked at my phone, and I went onto, you know, Wi-Fi. And it was like, call home, and call as soon as you can. And so it was this really surreal thing where I was in Berlin, and I didn't, you know, you sort of expect that you're going to have a sort of James Bond heroic moment where the clouds are going to part. Yeah, you're going to know exactly what to do. Don't worry, mum. Don't worry, brother. I'll be back. Everything's going to be great. But I froze. I didn't know what to do. There was this whole film crew waiting to do the short film. And so my brother was amazing. And he took control and said, look, it's really awful here. Because I didn't really even understand what a stroke... I mean, I knew what a stroke was, but I didn't really... I couldn't push the two things together in my head that dad had had a stroke. And I just didn't know what to do. And he said, just it's awful here. Come back in 2 days. We'll really look forward to seeing you. Stay, do the short film, and then come back. And then, obviously, because life's like this, I then did this short film and then completely fell for this German director of photography. He had, like,
I was, like, reading
hair.
About him. I was like... Any actor or actress can relate to being on set and falling in love with a... Yeah, I was like, oh, yeah. As soon as you mentioned him,
here we go.
I was like, Emily, stay away.
And so, and I'm so also... I'm such a sucker for kind of finding meaning in things. Like, I'm like, oh, my God, this terrible thing's happened. But look what life has given me. And I've got this big German man with floppy hair. And
I don't have to think about what's actually happening.
Exactly. And so then obviously, you can guess that this isn't going to end well, carry on. But then I had this really intense couple of days in Berlin. And then I go home to see my dad. And so everything is basically spilling out. Like, the emotions are just all over the shop. And so, looking back, to answer your question, it was a very, very long-winded answer, but there's a lot of stuff in those diaries that is just absolutely hideous and, like, really embarrassing, and a lot of really, really painfully kind of insecure and honest poetry. Because it's difficult sometimes, I think, with grief, because I think you are grieving as you're sort of losing your, you know, parent. You're going through a sort of pre-grief or something, and it's difficult to know what is being caused by what. Like, it just felt like everything was spilling out over the edge, and in trying to stay sane, that's what I was, you know, that's why I was keeping these diaries, and I was trying to sort of organize these really uncomfortable thoughts into poems. And so a lot of it is really hideous. I mean, a lot of it didn't make it in. I was like, this is too embarrassing. But then then also there's part of me that was like, actually, I do need to put, you know, I was a bit of a mess. So, you know, I've got to go there. I've got to, you know, and there is a lot that's very vulnerable, that's very exposed. And I think it needed to be in there.
Yeah, I thought it was really lovely. Yeah. You really captured that sense, which I really related to, despite our very different ages. You really captured that at the time, not now. You captured that sense of how it, like, it knocks you sideways, but, like, in your peripheral. So it's like, I really relate to that sense of, like, you sort of know something awful is going on, but in front of you there's all this normal life. And so you are very vulnerable because you're trying to keep this life going that's falling apart, you know, because a huge pillar of your life is dying. And so you're sort of, you know, getting up and having breakfast and flirting and falling in love and going clubbing. But at the same time, there's a voice in your head being like, but also your life, whole life is about to change. Like, it's such a, like you said, it's such a weird, slow motion set of emotions. And I thought the diary in your book was really interesting because I liked that it had that fresh, you know what I mean? It wasn't like the hindsight of like, oh yes, well, no, actually I now know I felt like this. It was like, no, that kind of chaos of like, I think he's okay. And like you said, with the stroke, like just not really knowing what that looks like until you see someone. And I know my granddad had a stroke just like 2 weeks before he passed away from it. And
did he? And
I remember, we went to see him, and it was like, it's such a shock, because it's so physical, isn't it? And it really does show on someone's face, you know, I think, especially, I guess, versus an early diagnosis of cancer where someone can seem very healthy but have their insides are not. So yeah,
it's very visible.
Yeah, like, so when you went back to see your dad, and we should say from the book you get this sense that your dad was a character a like huge personality, a headmaster, like just a loving figure in your life as well. So I can
And I think that physical aspect that you describe of a stroke was particularly devastating. I mean, it's devastating for anybody. It's not any more or less devastating.
No.
But Dad was so physical. Like, he was an active man. His big passion was rowing. You know, he was always out on the towpath when he was 70, he was driving a, you know, bicycle up the towpath and practically falling in, holding a loud hailer. And he was physical, and he walked a lot, and he was really active, and that was sort of very much part of his identity. And so that was, it was really devastating, like, to see somebody, you know, having to be winched out of bed, having to, you know, just losing all of your kind of, I don't know, just using your ability to be independent. It was really, really hard. But also there's that personality change that happens with a stroke. I don't know if that happened with your
grandfather. He wasn't around very much. Yeah, he could a little bit, but not really. Okay. And he was quite a quiet man anyway, so...
Okay.
You know, like, yeah. So, but I know, yes, I know what you mean. It's, it feels like a piece of them is kind of gone, I think, is essentially
Yeah, and there was this thing where we talked about crafting, which was this sort of mixture of laughing and crying at the same time. Because it was so, I mean, sometimes it was just, you just had to laugh because, I mean, you'd be crying and then you're just like, you just got to laugh. But the intensity of emotions after a stroke as well, it's like a layer's been stripped off. Mm. And it's almost like we could see right through to, you know, the very core of his being. There was no side at all. Not that his dad was sort of someone who would really ever kind of keep much back, but it was, you really could know exactly how he was feeling. And like, we described it as being like trying to keep a car from swerving off the road emotionally, because you'd be like, okay, people have written him like letters and we want to read them to him because we know that they'll make him happy, but then they also make him cry. So like, okay, stop reading the letters because he's crying now and then we need to cheer him up again. But it's just like, it was just so everything, like, you know. And he loved our dog Boris, and he's actually quite a big character in the book because, you know, they were best friends basically. And there was this lovely thing once where dad said, he liked to do a bit of painting, and I said, why don't you ever do any pictures of Boris? And he said, because I can't draw people. And which is how he thought of him. And you know, and when you'd mention, you know, because sometimes when you when you're recovering from a stroke, you asked to do tongue twisters, and there was one that was give the dog a biscuit, and dad's eyes again just welled up with tears just thinking about Boris. So it was so those early kind of weeks after dad had a stroke were so kind of extraordinary, really, and so intense, and yeah, just full of tears and laughing. And you know, he kept a sense of humor, which was so which, you know, meant a lot to us, because humor is something that's always really bonded us as a family.
And crafting is a good one. I like that. My mum used to always say, if you don't laugh, you cry. That's all she used to say. Yeah. So we would always laugh, but I think we might have to cry one day, like, but not right now. And that sense of the, like, how quickly the hospital becomes like your home. It's so weird. So how long, so what happened after he'd had the stroke? How long was he recovering for? You want to tell us about that?
So he was in hospital. So he had the stroke in September and then he died in January.
Right.
And initially the focus was like, you know, he's had a stroke, he needs to do some rehabilitation. And that wasn't going particularly well. He wasn't kind of making much progress. And he was moved from the John Radcliffe in Oxford to a smaller specialist stroke unit. And again, there was a little bit of progress, but not very much. And basically, we started to be concerned that there was something else going on, because he was very tired. He was exhausted. He was complaining of headaches. And there was a sort of fear that maybe that the cancer might have spread. And eventually we found out that he had widespread brain cancer that hadn't been detected.
Wow.
That had obviously related to his renal cancer. And so that was a massive shock. And a difficult thing for my parents, because I think dad was so ill and so tired. And but there was this treatment option. But even getting him out of bed, you know, to go to the loo was a massive ordeal, let alone getting in an ambulance. And there was an awful experience when he went in an ambulance to go and have his scans. And he was so sick. So it's an interesting one, because looking back on it, he was incredibly unwell. He was losing loads of weight, but we still didn't really think about him dying. Mm. We sort of always thought he's going to come home. We're going to get him home. The plan was, you know, if he can just get himself out of bed and into a wheelchair, then he can get out of, you know, a wheelchair into a car.
Yeah.
And the plan was, you know, we're going to get him home. And my mum was like, we're going to get him on the drugs and we're going to get him home. And that's what we were sort of, you know, planning, really. And that's sort of like, even when someone can be so frail and so unwell, we never expected that he was going to die.
Mm.
And I'm sure lots of people sort of describe that thing. I think Adam Buxton talked about that with, you know, his mum, just even though there's all the signs, that all the signs are there.
Yeah.
You just don't need to, because it's such a huge thing to even fathom.
I think it's just so, I think also your brain, like, protects you. I think the more I speak to people, it's like, you know it and you don't know it. You know, you do know. If someone had stopped you and shook your shoulders and been like, what do you think is going to happen? You would have been like, well, probably, it's probably bad. But, like, that voice is, you just keep sort of like layering over it of like, don't think about it, don't think about it. Today, what's today? Mm. What's today? It's getting him home. It's getting in the wheelchair. Like,
it's true.
You just focus on all these tiny things in front of you because to, you know, like, what is it? Marion Keyes quoted an amazing poet, which I've balls up before, but it's something like the truth shall dazzle us gradually lest it blind us. I can't remember who it is, sorry. And I that really stuck with me, apart from the author, because I was like, it's just this idea that you can't look at the truth square in the face. It takes time. Mm. It takes time. Mm. And especially when someone's sick, there's lots of distractions, you know, like there's lots of, and I remember like hospital, there's lots of chat, isn't there? Like, oh, we need to get their weight, or if they eat this, and there's all these sort of things that, and I feel like obviously no one directly is like, oh, because they are going to die, but we're just trying to do the best thing possible. Mm. So you sort of latch on to like, oh yeah, yeah. If they can walk to the loo, then they'll let them have a wheelchair, which means they can then go, like you latch on to these things because they feel like hope, I guess.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's something that's really helpful, is that you're living an hour at a time, sometimes a minute at a time. You're not thinking far beyond that. So I guess you're just not able to take in the kind of the big picture. It was actually, thinking about Dad's actual death is a really painful memory for me, because the nurses had all been worried about my mum because she was driving into hospital sort of three times a day, cooking Dad amazing meals. And she was actually a nurse. When she was younger, she was a midwife, and she's an amazing in a hospital. And she really kind of, it was a sort of strange thing that mum kind of came into her own in a ward. She'd practically be plumping the other guy's pillows in the ward and going around and sort of tidying them up. And she had that amazing energy of a nurse, and she was brilliant with Dad in hospital. But she was exhausted. Yeah. And the plan was, you know, we're going to get him home. So, there was this one day, it was the day before Dad died, one of the matrons sort of said, you know, we're a bit worried that your mum's going to burn out. We think she should have a day off. So why don't you tomorrow, you know, you come in, Emily, and, you know, well, we were going in every day but normally mum would come in a couple of times a day. But so why don't you go in the morning and then she'll come in the afternoon? And so this was my duty. I was in charge. I had to go in and be like on Dad duty. And as soon as I got in, I could see that he was really not good. Yeah. And he was crying out with pain in his chest. And it was this stupid thing where I was like, I'm in charge. I'm not going to call mum. I'm going to make sure. And I was talking to all the doctors, all the nurses, making sure everyone was coming to see him. They said, there's nothing to worry about. You know, it's, you know, he probably just needs some antibiotics, probably just a chest infection. But he was crying out in pain, and they sent me off to go and buy some heat packs from the local chemist, and I came back with the heat packs. None of it was working. I remember trying to buy some cream for a rash at the same time, and they wouldn't sell me two tubes of cream, and I just started crying. Oh, and I was just trying to hold it all together, and eventually their mum came in, and I felt awful that I hadn't been able to deal with the situation, and that, you know, mum was obviously so upset to see the state that Dad was in. And then mum and I had an argument about something really tiny, about, you know, putting a flannel on Dad's head. It was, the nurses had given us some cold water, and I went to put the flannel on his head, and mum was worried that it would be too cold, and, you know, sort of, don't put that on his head, it'd be too cold. It's a tiny thing, But of course, in my state, I was like, I can't cope with this. It's just, I'm too upset. And so I went off and cried in the, you know, waiting room, and then was like, I'm going home. And I went home, and then that was the night that Dad died. And so that was just this sort of really painful bit when I look back, that I, you know, my own, you know, don't tell me not to put the flannel on the head, it was just too much for me to cope with. Yeah. And I couldn't see the bigger picture. And I went home, and I think I ate sausages, and I went to bed, and then my phone wasn't turned on. And so my poor mum was trying to call me and say, you know, we've gone to the John Radcliffe. And eventually I got the messages because a neighbour came over and shouted my name outside the window.
Oh my God.
It's like the voice of God, except it was our neighbour Dave. And and actually I sort of feel okay talking about it now, because I've, you know, I have had to face up to that, and writing that and rewriting that was really, really painful. Mm. But in a way, in a strange way, my mum and dad had some time together in hospital before dad was transferred to the John Radcliffe. There was a sort of quiet period where his pain had gone down, and it was just the two of them in a quiet ward.
Yeah.
And I bet that, you know, must have meant the world to both of them, actually. And actually, I wasn't there, and that was just about them, which is where everything started. So that comforts me when I think about that. But yeah,
it's really hard. And I think you, like, so I can think of, I was gonna say hats off to you, but it's not a great phrase. Hats off to you. But what I meant was, like, I think it's really brave to be honest about how you actually feel when someone's dying, because I think so many of us tidy it up and we, like, get the ante back and we wipe it all down and we're like, no, this is actually how I behaved. And you don't. Like, I had a row with my dad, like, before, maybe like a couple of days before he died, before he, like, really lost, like, wasn't really with it. And I don't really remember speaking to him properly after that. And it, like, all these things, because you feel this internal pressure of, like, I should be doing this, and I should be, almost like you said about your mum, like, plumping pillows, being helpful. But she's a trained nurse. Like, she knows how to deal with someone dying. And I think most of us don't. And I think especially, like, of course you had a row with your mum, like, you're exhausted, you're so stressed, and you can see he's dying. And that really is what that is. It's two people both saying to each other, I don't want him to die. Like, that's what the flannel conversation is, isn't it? It's like, I don't want this, I don't want this. Well, I don't want this either. Well, I now I'm upset. And it's just, we have to be honest about what happens in these, at these hospital moments, because we can free each other from the shame of it. Because I know so many people who've done stuff like that. I've had so many guests who've talked about those moments of, like, you know, leaving to go and get tea, leaving to go to the shops because they just couldn't face being in that room anymore. And, like, I know how hard it is when you sort of carry it with you for a bit. And I'm glad that you have written about it and now can be like, yeah, it happened. It doesn't mean you didn't care, you didn't love him, or you did anything wrong. It's like, somebody dying is such a, I think the thing, we have such an idea that it's going to be like an on-off. Like, they'll be there, then they'll die. It's like, no, they, dying takes time. It takes hours, and their body slowly breaks down. And, you know, there's parts of that you're great at, and there's parts of it you're not great at, because it's so fucking painful to watch someone you love be in pain. I think, you know, I think it's really great that you have been able to get that wound out into the air, I suppose.
Yeah.
What I mean. Yeah.
Thank you. And I will never forget, actually, a beautiful thing was, I think I'd always assumed that I mean, and I know this is different for every person, but when Dad actually died, the moment that he died, it was a strangely beautiful thing. And it was a thing where I just knew that he had gone, and there was a sort of energy that got sort of sucked out of the room. There was just this feeling of, like, that's it. And I just knew. And then he was really gone. And then it was like, no, you're not here anymore. That life force, that spirit, whatever that is, like, that is gone. And that was kind of incredible to witness. And sort of makes it easier when you then eventually have to say goodbye to them. You're like, okay, well, we've stood here, we've talked to him, we've told him we love him. You know, you spend hours sort of not knowing what to do. And me, my sister, my brother and my mum laughing, crying again, sort of like going through the whole Rolodex of emotions. And then it kind of helped when we did eventually say goodbye to him, to know that, yeah, that spirit, that life force, whatever you think it is, wasn't there anymore. Like, it was gone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
It's a really strange thing, isn't it, when you actually see it go? It's like I feel like that's a real, like, I sort of felt like, why has no one ever said that happens? Why have I never seen this on any sort of media, film, television? I've never seen like someone just not be there. And like you said, it is, you really do see, especially if it is somebody who's a big personality and you kind of like, you know, is full of life and energy and active. And when they're not, you're like, oh, I see, there's a body. That's all that's left now. All that was them is not there, and it's a really strange experience. So you were all together when he finally passed away.
So when he finally passed away, me and my mum were there, and then my sister and brother came very shortly afterwards. It happened like in the middle of the night, so they were transferred at around 3 o'clock in the morning. So it was difficult to get through to people. But it's funny with the sort of thinking about spring. Like spring felt so meaningful in 2014.
Yeah.
Like even the birds, like I wrote poetry about it, like the kind of the birds and the new buds bursting through and the heat on your face. And I just felt like Dad was kind of everywhere. Like I felt like he was the birds. I felt like he was the sort of sunshine. Ridiculous. But it was again that feeling of that he'd sort of gone somewhere. He was sort of free, I guess. And he'd been trapped in this, you know, in his body, and that sort of sense of freedom. And that's a massive cliche, isn't it, to be so kind of into spring.
Well, the one we always talk about on the show is that I really stayed with me is they say you have to experience every season without them. Because it's like your brain is like, they didn't see the flowers, they didn't see the sunshine, they didn't see the leaves, they didn't see the snow. They're gone. And I think I sort of feel I wonder what it's like if you don't live in a four season country, because like our seasons are so distinct and so clear, and like the cycle is so fucking clear that I completely understand. My dad died in the April, so we were like in the spring, so I had that sort of weird sensation of like, as my grief got bigger, it got colder and darker, like it grew with the grief.
Yeah.
But I completely understand that feeling. And when my mother-in-law died, it was just as all the bluebells had come out, and she like literally lived in a bluebell wood. And so I remember like we went out, and then it was just like this sensation of like life going on. And I think it's a cliche for a damn good reason, because it's true. Stuff like that can really help heal, offer something to your soul when you are in the depths of grief, you know. And it's like, especially, you know, I can understand someone dying in at winter time. It feels like everything's dead, you know, like that's it feels like everything's dying and dead, and it is. And then being able to acknowledge, oh, life goes on. And it's it's a fucking cliche, but it's a good reminder. Life does go on. It does.
Life
like
does go on.
You are still alive. Things are still growing. Things will still the birds will appear as they do every year. And I think stuff like that is integral to a kind of recovery, which why we talked a lot about on the show about what happened during COVID is, well, I hated the first lockdown, you know, obviously, as most people did. But the thing that I hated was it felt like grief had taken over. So when you have lost someone, you're like, you don't want anyone to be out and about enjoying themselves. You want everyone to be inside grieving like you are. And then when it felt like the world had stopped, I was like, this is awful. I want to be reminded. I want to see that life is going on. Like, you need that. It's such a primal thing.
Yeah, definitely.
So how was that first? You said like you ran away from it for a while. Like, did you feel that? Yeah, what did it look like? What did your running away look like?
I think my running away, I mean, I think I quite literally ran away. There was one morning I stayed with my mum for a few months, and I really wanted to do that, and I really wanted to be there. And And then one morning she describes, I sort of arrived at the kitchen like, I'm off to London, bye mum, sort of thing. And I was just, I really wanted to get back to my normal life. I wanted to see friends. I wanted to work. I wanted to go out and yeah, just like to have fun, I think, because it had been really intense, the hospitals and the just the sort of long, dark winter. And so, yeah, I was really lucky to have a few jobs to sort of jump into. And I ended up going to Morocco to film something out there, which was a bit of an adventure. And then I ended up filming something actually not too far from my mum, so I could pop back and forward. But yeah, my sort of running away was just keeping busy.
Yeah.
And just having these sort of occasional bursts of massive tears. but I don't know how well I was really dealing with it, because I think naturally I'm quite a positive person, and I didn't find it very easy to be that vulnerable about how I was feeling.
Yeah.
I think I'm you know, hugely changed now, and I'm much more able to talk about the sort of the dark, ugly bits, the sort of, you know, the sad bits. But I think I always felt a bit of a responsibility to be the sort of fun person who was all positive. And so that doesn't go that well with grief, I would say.
It's a bit tricky, yeah.
Yeah, I think people just used to think I was coping really well. They were just coping really well. but then privately, I think it was a very private thing for me. The kind of the crying was something that happened in private, and I would almost find it a bit uncomfortable when people who'd also lost a parent would sort of talk to me about it, and they'd have so much understanding in their eyes, and they sort of hold my hand, and I remember just feeling like, oh no, this doesn't feel right, no, please.
I'm not in your club, I'm not like you, I'm actually fine, you seem quite damaged, but I'm weirdly fine, I don't know, I'm just really lucky, I'm one of those people, it hasn't affected me. I used to always say things like, look, my dad died when I was 15, it's just not a big deal, it's just one of those things, some people, you know, their parents get divorced at 15 or they move house, my dad died, no big deal, like these things that you build up to protect yourself, like I am not vulnerable, I am definitely not vulnerable. And it's funny, isn't it, that like I wonder how you feel about this, like as actors, I would find any, like that's why I went to comedy, because I found anything that made me feel vulnerable in performing was like, ah, run away. So it was like, you know, when they would say like, oh, use your experience, or what do you have? And I'd be like, no thanks, that box is fully locked and we are not opening it. So I was like, comedy was so great because comedy's full of people who are like, I don't want to talk about it. So that was such a big thing for me of running. That was my form of running, of like to this world where people didn't want to talk about it. And then the more I talk about it, the less comedy, like as in gigs, I started doing. Because I was like, oh, I'm kind of okay with being vulnerable now. And that doesn't fit in that well in comedy. And I was like, oh, no. Yeah, how was that for you? Like, were you in the jobs? Did you just kind of put on another face of like...
Yeah, I mean, it was quite weird because I ended up... Grief kind of was really coming at me from the... Like, I played a grieving wife.
Oh,
I played a grieving daughter.
Oh, God.
I like, all the roles, like, you know, were kind of really sort of smacking me in the face. I mean, there was one particular job that I did where I was... Yeah, my father had died and I had to sort of... We had to do the death scene and it was a bit... He looked little bit too much like Dad. And I don't know if you have this problem sometimes, Carrie, but when you have to cry on cue,
there's
a sort of like, oh God, I have to cry, I gotta cry.
Yeah.
And the focus on this job was just not to have a complete panic attack. I was like, I'm so emotional. And it was actually kind of embarrassing. I was like, I think I might need to just like have a bit of a time out here, because it was a really surreal moment. That was the closest I've come to kind of really losing it. Because,
I mean, that's,
he just looked like my dad. He looked a bit like my dad.
That's awful.
Really surreal.
I really feel for you, because people describe like, oh, I was on the tube and I saw someone who looked like him and it was very painful. No one is like, oh, I had to relive a father dying, pretend I was his daughter and it looked like my dad. Like, that's like immersion therapy.
Yeah, that was pretty intense. But I think, those first few years, I went out a lot. I kind of wanted to sort of have a lot of fun. And then it really was that kind of, you know, just, it was like 3 years later, just had that real urge to just actually, I want to look at these book diaries. I want to write it all. I want to write it, you know, out. And I cried buckets doing that. But it was an amazing experience. And I think after that, it was less kind of up and down. And I think I was just a little bit more sad than normal in a kind of permanent way. And I sort of leveled out in a slightly more kind of, you know, vulnerable, probably normal way, if that makes sense. Just to sort of myself, but just dialed a bit back down and a little bit more sad than normal.
Did you go to any professional therapy or anything like that?
I did. And the reason I went actually was because I had really bad anxiety. I felt I had sort of like, you know, that whole thing of like, oh my God, what am I going to say? What am I going to say to people? I can't think of what I'm going to say to people. And sort of anxiety about seeing them. Again, I mean, this is from someone who claimed to be coping quite well and clearly wasn't. But I was, I found that really difficult. And again, on listening to Griefcast, I think it was the Julia Samuels episode where she talked about, you know, of course you're anxious because your life has been built on these two pillars. And when one of them gets taken away, you have a whole new identity. You have like your whole sense of self is, you know, is shaken. And you have to re-find your identity as a daughter without a father, and you have to re-find yourself, and that is really weird and scary, and you don't feel like yourself, and it makes so much sense looking back that of course I would have felt anxious and a bit rudderless and a bit exposed and a bit vulnerable, because you know this huge figure in my life was gone, and that was something that I had to work on quite a lot in therapy.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked about it on the show. Like, I have terrible anxiety. It's sometimes better than it is, but like, I remember my therapist saying, like, you know, like something about like a normal level of anxiety, and I remember thinking, what is that? What's a normal level? She was like, on a scale of 1 to 10, like, where do you see yourself? I was like, I mean, who isn't at 9, right? Like, we're all at 9. And she was like, some people are at 1. I was like, who are these people? Who are they? They have nothing to worry about. But I think grief is a real... I ain't no expert, but I think grief ties in so much with anxiety because the idea that you're out of control, think people can die, people can get ill, and there's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can touch wood or, you know... see a black cat as much as you like, and you can eat well, and you can do all these things, and people will still die. And that's a really scary life lesson, even though it's a very true life lesson, and it's something we all have to accept, and we all have to walk through that, you know, idea and take it into our heart. It's really frightening. And I think it's really interesting what you're saying about going out and having fun, because I think that's again so common, because and all these things that we sometimes judge ourselves for, but actually, like, of course you want to go and live because someone's just died. So you want to be like, I'm alive, I can live. Like, it doesn't have to be this experience. But I guess what I feel with this show and, like, so many, what I want with so many talking to people is just for everyone to realise, like, whatever you're doing after someone's died is probably quite normal. But
it's
we kind of go, oh, why am I doing this? Or why am I having fun? Or why am I crying? It's like, it's just because someone's died. Like, it's what is, you know, you're just trying to figure it out. And I think we are, hard on ourselves. But that's why I think it's such an amazing process that you, one, wrote it down, and then two, were able to go back to it. Because it's kind of like, I mean, you literally did put it in a box and then open it.
I did.
You know, it took me so long to even admit there was a box. Even go, well, I guess we could open it. So I think that's a really sort of healthy way, in a way. Not that, you know, there's no right or wrong, there's just whatever works for you. And you mentioned as well, like, becoming a mum. So when did you have your daughter? How old is she?
So I had her, she was a lockdown baby. She was born in May 2020. And weirdly, she was born in the hospital that my dad died in.
Wow.
So she was meant to be born in UCLH. But because of COVID, we ended up not being in London. It seemed like a better idea. And so she was born at the John Radcliffe. And so that was a kind of lovely full circle thing. And I haven't allowed myself to dwell on it too much about, like, dad not meeting her. And because if I do go there, I sort of wrote in that in my book, it's like a sort of landslide. I could just slip and just disappear down a massive hole. And so it's interestingly, when Romy was born, she had the heel prick test, as all babies have. And, you know, and I was just like, oh, we're never going to hear anything, da la la. And then we got a phone call from Great Ormond Street. And she has a very rare genetic condition, but it's manageable, and it's been totally fine. And, you know, we sometimes have to take her into hospital just to make sure she's okay. But that was a massive shock, getting that phone call. We were just sitting there with our two-day-old baby, just completely in love. And interestingly, it's moments like that that I really, really miss my dad. Mm. And I have my mum, and I you know, rely on her so much emotionally. But it's that feeling of them knowing what to do, or them just saying that everything's going to be okay, and that sort of just containing you in the way that parents can. And that it's been those moments, you know, those kind of really vulnerable, even when you're an adult and I'm, you know, in my late 30s, you just want your dad sometimes and you just want them to take control. And, you know, as he would often when I had, you know, different life issues, he'd sort of always have brilliant advice and kind of be there. So that's been difficult. And it's quite funny, Romy is obsessed with this photograph of him on the fridge, to the point where I think it's actually been ripped in half. She's kind of like, to play with it, she's like, Nick. But, you know, we do talk about him, and I want her to sort of grow up knowing that he's, you know, that's her grandfather, one of her grandfathers. So that's when it's kind of come up. And then also when I was pregnant, I went into a church and lit a candle for Dad, as I sometimes do, and I suddenly had that realization that they were never going to meet each other, and that was really awful. And so I had a massive cry about that. And then there was a weird moment actually when Romy was being born. I don't know how woo woo you are, Carrie, but I have.
I'm pretty woo woo. Pretty woo. Yeah.
You woo. You have your woo moments, but the lights went. There was a weird moment when Romy was just about to be born, when all the lights went out in the room. And there's been a few sort of electrical things that have happened
where
lights have sort of flickered, or radios have come on in the middle of the night. And I've just made the decision to just go, that's Dad. And I've, you know, he's just here, just saying hi. And that was a really strange moment. Just when all the lights went out and then they all came on again. But I like to believe that he's communicating with me through the medium of electricity.
Why not? Like, why not? Like, it gives you comfort. And like, I just, you know, there's the old superstition. If you see a white feather, it's like someone you've lost saying hello.
Oh, really?
And a friend's little girl had a white feather, and she was like, oh, it's my nanny. And the mum looked a bit like, oh, I've told her this, sorry. And I was like, no. I was like, my God, like, take it where you can. Like, I just think, I don't know, like, these things, if it brings comfort and it's not harmful and it's not, you know, seriously damaging your mental health in any way, then why not? Maybe he, you know, he died there. Why not? That to me, I would definitely find stuff like that. I'm all for that. And I think it's a really hard process that they don't meet them. And
Have you found that?
And that was a real, it was funny, like, because he died when I was so young, I was like really prepped, like, you know, he didn't know what I got for my GCSEs, didn't know my A-levels, didn't know I went to exam, wasn't at my wedding, like all this stuff I was like very, very prepared for. And I hadn't quite thought, oh, he won't meet them. I kind of thought like, oh, I won't have him around when I have kids. But obviously they didn't exist. So when you see this person in front of you and you're like, oh, they won't get to meet them. And I like this person, my child, and I would like them to meet them because they were also interesting. So it's like, I think it's quite a hard thing to conceive of until you have conceived and have a child in front of you, or however you have a child in front of you. It doesn't have to be through natural conception. So I think, it's difficult. And I think the other problem with it, as ever, with grief, is it evolves. So when she was a baby, it was sad because she was a baby. And now she's like running around as a nutcase five-year-old. I'm like, oh, he would have liked this bit as well. So you're constantly having to kind of check in with yourself and be like, oh, okay, that's sad. And I try these days just to sort of let it be and just be like, yeah, that's really sad. And that's taken a lot of therapy and years of doing this podcast to just go, yeah, God, that's sad. Whereas I used to obviously be like, don't think about it. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, block it out. And so I find that more helpful now, just to be like, gosh, that's very sad. Because it is really sad they don't get to meet them. It is really sad. And it's really important, I think, to talk about them. And I think you can get a sense of someone. And I try and remember that. Like, I had like a crazy set of great aunts and great uncles and great grandparents that obviously I didn't meet, but I remember the stories about them. And they're very sort of real to me. So I try and think, well, they did a good job of making those people really real. So perhaps I can do a good job of making this person really real. And I think as long as you, talk about them, and they know that you're okay to talk about them, that's a lovely thing. I just think that's all you can do.
Do you find yourself kind of doing things that your dad maybe did as a parent? Do you sort of, because sometimes there can be a nice connection there where you feel a bit like you sort of find yourself using language they would have used or sort of doing games that they might have played.
I mean, this is where it becomes tricky, because my dad was definitely not the world's top dad. So your dad sounds like a really lovely, jolly fellow, and no shade to my dad, but he was a complicated man. And so that's quite helpful, actually. I don't particularly, a parent like my mother, really, apart from occasionally shouting like him. But yeah, when my brother, we were all on holiday, and my brother, out of nowhere to all like the kids, he's got kids as well, was like, come on, Chillywinks in the car. And I was like, Chillywinks? That's what my dad used to call us. And it really froze me, because I was like, you know, when you're like in two places, I was literally in a child and I was my adult self at the same time. And I was like, wow, that word and he sounds like my dad a bit. Doesn't look like him at all, but he sounds like him. I was like, oh my God. And then I sort of looked at him and he was like, oh yeah. Like, you know, you don't even know where that's come from. He was like, oh yeah, that's one of dad's things, isn't it? So yeah, I find it in some ways easier because he wasn't particularly around when we were kids. So it doesn't bring up any memories of that. But yeah, it's just certain phrases and stuff. Have you found like he obviously was a great dad. So
he was very kind. A very, very kind person and a very selfless person. And actually had a weird thing. Facebook sometimes pops up and reminds you of things. And yesterday I had this weird reminder that I'd been walking along, a year after Dad died, I'd been walking to read through for Doc Martin.
Oh, yeah.
And I was feeling quite nervous. And I was walking along the river. And so Dad's, big passion was rowing. And he had a boat that was named after him called the Nick Bevan. And there was a big regatta going on, because it was in Hammersmith. And I was just literally walking along. And out of the water, right in front of me, came out the Nick Bevan, practically knocking me off the towpath. Which was so weird. Like one of those moments of synchronicity. And so it's just sort of moments of feeling like, I don't know, the universe is complicated, but that was an amazing moment that happened. And so I'm comforted by the idea that things like that can happen, and that although he's gone, I do try and sort of be like him, I think, definitely. I think I admired him a lot, and I was very close to him, and so I think that's a sort of way of keeping him alive, by sort of trying to be a bit like him in various ways, although we're very different. It's just an ongoing process, isn't it?
It is.
And ever changing, and I wonder what it will look like in another 10 years.
Yeah.
And how I'll feel about it. I definitely feel like I went through a phase of feeling like I was a bit of an expert on grief, and kind of being the person wanting to sort of talk to anyone who'd lost a parent, and sort of having been like completely, you know, detached from it all, then being like, okay, this is what I want to talk about.
I mean, yeah, I'm definitely, I think I'm still in that phase.
You're very good at it.
Oh, bless you. But I mean, thank you so much. It was so nice to talk to you and remember Nick.
It was really lovely to chat to you.
And oh my God, that story that the boat came by and waved, you know, said hello to you. That is so nice. What a nice thing. What a nice way to, and not scary. That's like a really non-scary way to be like, hello. That's lovely. But thank you so much for remembering him. He sounds awesome.
It was so lovely to chat to you, Carrie. Thank you so much.
You can follow Emily on Twitter at Emily Grace Bevan. That is Bevan. Her book, The Diary of Losing Dad, A Bittersweet Journey Through Grief, is published by Unbound, and you can buy that now. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was recorded remotely, I think in both our living rooms. It was edited by Kate Holland. The music was by The Glue Ensemble. Artwork by Jade Perkin. And remember, you are not alone. That sounded a bit harsh, so I sounded quite meanly. Sorry, I meant you're not alone. I'm here for you as well. But Apologies if that sounded a bit sharp.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.